Captain John Docherty, 26th of April, 1997. Captain Docherty, perhaps we can start by you giving us an overview of your time with the RCN prior to you becoming ACNTS Air in 1950.
Yes. Well, I'm a little bit of a mixture. I've been called half and half because I was born in Canada. I went to England in 1929 and didn't return to Canada, so I came back in HMCS Warrior in 1946. During my time in England, after college, I joined the Hawker Aircraft Company as an aeronautical engineering apprentice. I guess my biggest memory of that is when I was sent into the experimental department, and the manager told me that he wanted somebody to help him in the office because they were going to build a new interceptor. This was in the 30s, and of course the interceptor turned out to be the Hurricane. So I always consider a little bit of my life went into the Hurricane, although I was nothing more than the glorified office boy running between the drawing office and the manager of the experimental shop. But I learned a lot about airplanes. After that, I spent a little time in Hawker's design office, but decided that wasn't the world for me, and went out on the operating side. And in 1938, I think, I became deputy chief engineer of a big flying school with operating military aircraft for the RAF. When the war broke out, that was closed and moved to Canada. And I took a job converting Morris Motors, Oxford, Cowley plant near Oxford, into a Hurricane and Spitfire repair for the Air Force, and later managed to talk my way out of that and was offered a direct entry commission into the Royal Navy in December 30th, 1940. I ended up as an acting temporary sub-lieutenant in the Royal Navy. I served in the Royal Navy. Unfortunately, no seagoing appointments. Then East Africa, Tanganyika. Later on, Flag Officer Air East Indies staff in Colombo, Ceylon. I came back to Admiralty. Well, when in Admiralty, a fellow named Arthur Garrity, well known to a lot of naval types because he was in the RCN for some years, walked into my office and changed my life. He said to me, he'd come asking some information about the fleet air arm and the engineering side. And he said to me, and I said, well, what are you interested? You've come over from the Canadian headquarters. And he said, oh, didn't you know? We're starting a fleet air arm. And I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. I was born in Canada. And before I knew it, he talked me into putting in an application to transfer to the Canadian Navy. I was still an RNVR officer, and I transferred to the RCNVR under rather entertaining circumstances because I was in the air branch there, and we used to wear an A in the curl. But Canada didn't have that, and they didn't know what to do with me. The engineers said, oh, we don't have any aeronautical engineers except one that I knew they had was Spike Morris, but he'd been a marine engineer, and Dennis Foley. But we weren't in the engineering branch, so I finally went to see in a Canadian ship as an unqualified executive officer. Later on, they transferred us to the engineering branch. rather entertaining entry into that one. I joined the warrior as air engineer officer, then later to the air base at Shearwater, which was an air section, so I'd commissioned into a full naval air base. Then I went to headquarters in 1950 to take over from Captain Caldwell, who was then ACNTSR and the Director of Aeronautical Engineering.
All right, perhaps if we can just stop there for a moment and go back a little bit. You talked about your aircraft engineering apprenticeship with the Hawker Aircraft Company in England. Now, that was a five-year apprenticeship?
I did a five-year, yes.
And what would that normally entail? That would involve the practical experience. What sort of coursework would you
there
receive?
Was also, we attended Kingston Institute of Technology, sometime during our own time and sometime during the company's time.
So after a combination of 5 years of coursework and practical experience under a qualified or certified engineer, you received your ticket or your diploma?
Yeah, well, it was a bit odd. I got shifted down to Brooklyn some places, and I never took any final exams. Something I've always regretted, but you were young when I was down on their flight testing, when the Hurricane was doing its flight testing and things like that, and I guess that fell into the background because I tended to drop out a bit just towards the end, and I never wrote any exams. Now, that's honest. The Royal Aeronautical Society, of course, has acknowledged that I had been around a long time, and some years ago they made me a fellow of the Royal Aeronautical Society in England.
Oh, great. So following your apprenticeship, and after you had joined the RCNVR, following the war, you became the air engineer officer aboard HMCS Warrior, and that was for 2 years. Did you go off and do any additional courses during that time?
When I was in Warrior, I can't recall doing any courses. Later on, I went and did a series of courses after I'd become chief at Shearwater.
And this was your next posting following Warrior?
That's right, and I did a number of courses then.
Where would you have been sent for those courses when you were based at Shearwater?
I was sent to England because, for a number of reasons. One, we were getting Sea Furies and Fireflies, and I did courses at Bristol, Hawkers. I also did a damage control course. I can't recall any others, but I was over there about 2 months, I think, doing courses. Could have been three.
And this was during your time when you were at Shearwater?
Yes. Now, the senior engineer was an exchange officer called Tuck, took over when I was away.
Now, just to go back once again for a moment, when you joined the RNVR, you had some naval aviation familiarization courses. What sort of what would that entail? Was that as an observer?
That was all rather entertaining because the first two weeks was a divisional course at Portsmouth when it was being bombed. So we didn't do too much work. The night was spent under the Victory Mess, where there was shelters, and I happened to lose a bomb landed on my cabin that night, and all my everything I possessed in the way of clothing, because I was in civilian clothing, and disappeared as well. My uniform was gone. And then I went to Leon Solent for 3 months to train on a naval experience and gain naval aviation experience. I had been there about 2 weeks when I was called into the chief engineer of the Leon Solis office, and he said, "The naval officer in charge, Stapleford Tawney's broken his leg. You've got to get up there right away and take over." Well, it didn't mean anything to me, and I found out that Stapleford Tawney was a packing unit for sending aircraft overseas, and it was being there was a few naval ratings there breaking the aircraft down, and it was being packed by a civilian company, and Stapleford Tawney was then a satellite to North Wheel fighter stage. They said I was only going to be there 2 weeks. I ended up there being suddenly called back 3 months later and told, in 2 weeks' time, you're supposed to sit examinations. And the senior engineer said, "John, I don't think, you know, it's not fair on you." And I said, "Well, let me have a go." He said, "Well, it's the naval procedures." And I said, "I think I know the naval procedures, because at Stapleford Tawney, I was a little sub-lieutenant. I didn't know anything. I didn't even know what a naval message was or anything like that. Nobody had told me about all these things, and I used to be getting all these." In the end, I think I knew much more about naval procedures than anybody who'd been studying with you. So let me take the exam. And I said, "I'm not frightened of the technical exam." And so he said, "All right, but I don't think it's fair on you." And I said, "Well, let me take it on the administration one." And I came up top of the group on administration. All the others had been attending lectures. I just learned it the hard way because I didn't know what was going on, what all the bits of paper were. Strange.
Very
and then I went up to Scotland from there, to an air base in Scotland.
So prior to you joining the RCNVR, and even when you were aboard Warrior, you go to Shearwater in 1947. All of your experience as it relates to naval aviation was with fixed-wing aircraft.
Oh, very much so, yes.
So, but when you come to Shearwater, that would have been about a year before, or 2 years perhaps, before the RCN had even procured its first helicopter.
Yeah, I was trying to remember when the Bells were produced. We had a couple of Bells, and then we bought some more when I was ACNTS Air. I remember going down to Bells at that time, and that was a small Bell, of course.
That would have been the 47 with 47, the bubble canopy?
Yeah, that was the one.
Now, that was procured primarily for operating off the icebreaker for
that's
ice
right.
patrols
that's
and
right.
surveillance and that sort
that's
of
right.
sort of thing. But when you were at Shearwater as the air engineer officer, do you remember Shearwater having any helicopters at that time? Or would that have been a bit too early?
I think it was too early. I don't think we had any at that time. I really can't recall whether we had any, but I remember getting when we bought them from Sikorsky, so we couldn't have had them unless we had some before, but we did go down, because I remember going, not from Sikorsky, from Bell.
Right.
And we went down there, and I remember particularly because we got in a terrible hassle down there with that in those days. If we used a civilian contractor to get quality control and sign up, we worked through the Air Force. And we'd asked the Air Force and told them that we were buying these, and would they arrange? Well, the Air Force worked with the U.S. Army. And the Bell plant was a naval plant, and the U.S. Army were asked to do this. Well, they had to tell the U.S. Navy to do it on behalf. Well, somewhere along the line, the message didn't get through. When the aircraft were ready, to be taken over. The DSS, or as it was called, DDP in those days, Department of Defense Production, the contract called for acceptance by the ICF. And the arrangement they had was to go through the chain. Well, the ICF wouldn't accept them. They had nothing to do with it. The U.S. Navy wouldn't accept them because they hadn't been told. The U.S. Army just flapped and said, well, we don't know. I guess the message didn't get passed through to the Navy. So we had to get an arrangement with the Air Force that we could accept them on behalf of the ICAF and the American Army, who was doing that job, and the U.S. Navy, and we had to go right through the train before DDP would sign the contract that we could take them away from the factory and pay the bill.
Oh boy, that's a terrible system. Now, is that partly due to, is that partly due to the sharing or the dual arrangement between the RCAF and the RCN in the post-war period, that the Air Force had control of procurement and maintenance?
No, they didn't have control over maintenance at all, but any any quality control outside the Navy was in the Air Force agreement that they did it. Later on, we managed to change. But it just shows you what a bureaucratic tangle you could get into, and not being too au fait with the workings of Canada and the States. We never got into it again, I assure you.
Fortunately.
No, we learned our lesson.
So when you came to headquarters in July of 1950 and were appointed Assistant Chief of Naval Technical Services Air, and Director of Air Engineering, what was your rank at that time?
Commander. But there was a little gap in there because Caldwell held the job and I took over from him, and I think there was a period of 6 months when he was still there and then we were both there and then he went off.
So were you double-hatted for your entire time at headquarters then?
Oh, yes. 50
through 53? So if you could, for the benefit of the listener, tell us if you can remember what the terms of reference were for both ACNTS Air and Director of Air Engineering.
I think you're pushing my memory a bit. But in generally, we were responsible for all technical... Well, I think you got to go and break it down a bit, go back a bit. Because in those days, headquarters in the Navy was broken down by trade, or what do we call it? There was the electricals, the engineering, all the rest, and the ordnance. Well, electrical engineering, Director of Aeronautical Engineering was responsible to the engineering chief. Assistant Chief of Naval Technical Services there was responsible to the Chief of Naval Technical Services. The Air Electrics came under Electrical Engineer-in-Chief, and the Ordnance came under somebody. Now, the function of ACNTS Air was to coordinate all the activities of the other branches who had a technical responsibility for aircraft. In actual fact, you did the whole thing, but that's the way it was on paper, and that went on paper until 19, after I returned, and technical services were reorganized, and we became Director General Aircraft. I don't know.
That would have been. DGA then would have
that's
been the acronym.
DGA, that's right. And then everything technical came under us. But in actual work, it all came under us anyway.
Right.
Because the others weren't all that very interested.
So as director of air engineering, you would have, and your staff would have been responsible for airframes and engines?
Engines, yes.
And avionics or electrical would have been under a separate director.
Yeah, but as ACNTS Air,
you coordinated all of them.
And the ordnance one and the air ordnance one. Rest. It was a rather confused organization. In fact, you just ran the whole thing. Nobody interfered with you too much in the aviation those days.
Was both the ACNTS Air and the Air Director Air Engineering staff, were they very small during the early 1950s?
Yes, they were quite small, and I'm trying to remember. I really couldn't tell you how big they were. I think that we have they were somewhere about 20, I think, because
combined
we nobody else was able, was on the ACNTS Air staff. See, he did both jobs, and so it all came under one great thing,
right?
Operating, and it was very difficult to sort out. And ACNTS Air just gave you a route through to the direct to the Chief of Naval Technical Services, and the other work you had to go through the engineering chief.
How would you, during your time at headquarters, how would you characterize your relationship while you were double-hatted with Director of Naval Aviation and his staff, like staff officer helicopters, for example?
Oh, we had a very close relationship. We weren't very, very well together all the time. You may have had differences of opinion, but, you know, my recollection is, and I'm trying to recall who was on the staff in those days. I think Ted Edwards was on the staff. We had loan officers. We had the well-known Keeley Peach. He's a wonderful man. We had two or three Americans in those days. We had another British Commodore. Of course, there were only Commodores in Canada, because in the Royal Navy, Commodore is not a rank, it's an appointment, which rather confuses people. They always go back, and then he has to be appointed Commodore again.
Right. So would that have been Sears? Harold Sears?
Don't remember Harold Sears at all. Name rings a bell. There was a Sears in England, but Bill Sears? I'm just trying to think who was that.
I'll just stop the tape for a moment here. So the Commodore that we're talking about here is Commodore Keeley Peach.
Keeley Peach.
Who was RN and fixed-wing aviator. Now, he was there during your time in headquarters, which was the same time that the Navy, the RCN, was looking to procure the HUP-2 helicopter from the Piasecki Corporation in the United States. I'm wondering if you can recall some of the problems with the early helicopters from your perspective as Director of Air Engineering and ACNTS Air.
Well, I think the HUP-2 was not in service for the Canadian Navy until I'd left Ottawa in those days.
Right. But you had written a number of reports investigating some of the problems with the HUP-2 helicopter. You suggested that the RCN not procure this particular aircraft at that time. Do you recall what some of the difficulties were with the aircraft?
There was an engine problem, and I can't remember exactly what that was. They had a bad record of engine failures. Where I'd been to the U.S. Navy and talked to them. They had we had a staff requirement, and it didn't meet the staff requirement. So, in many ways, now I know I wasn't responsible for making that staff requirement. but I always felt it was my job that if they were going to buy a piece of equipment that didn't meet the staff requirement, I should tell them they didn't meet the staff requirement. We had many discussions, but I don't recall bad blood in any of this.
Right.
You know, and Keeley Peach was very good. And I can recall, I have much better recollections of Keeley Peach with respect to the tracker and the Banshee. And I remember both those meetings in his office where we all sat down and we all gave our opinions on the various aircraft, what we thought of them. And we were looking at the tracker and also the Banshee. And certainly Keeley Peach listened to all sides before he would make his decision, but the decision tended to obviously remain with staff.
If we can just go back for a moment, you said that you didn't have a role to play per se in writing up staff requirements for the helicopters. Would you and your staff certainly be consulted in the process of writing the staff requirements?
In those days, I don't think staff requirements were quite as well written as they had in the past, and thorough, as the aeroplanes got more complicated and had more roles to perform. Certainly, when it came to the Sea King, we were in right from the start on the Sea King, helping with the staff requirements. And then later we wrote the total specification for the aircraft.
Is part of the problem with the early staff requirements and the early helicopters explained in part because of the experimental technology of the aircraft itself?
Yeah, I seem to recall that the Hup was the only one that we had a disagreement on. That's my recollection. Hup gave us good service in the end, but,
after modifications by the manufacturer.
Modification by the manufacturer and things, but it was always a very, very costly craft to maintain.
Do you remember when you were at headquarters having the occasion to go down and visit the Piasecki plant in the United States?
I remember that extremely well. And if I told you that one of the reasons I remember that very well, it was a very odd reason.
And that being?
That being that they'd asked me out to dinner one night, and as I overheard a conversation, "Get that so-and-so drunk tonight, because the meeting's tomorrow, and we know he's challenging that. So take him out and fill him." That's right, I heard this conversation. And I thought, well, if that's the way you feel, we'll have a little party tonight. I reckon I can drink any of you guys out. And I cheated a bit, I tossed away. The true story.
So they wanted to...
And we went on, and every time they said, "Well, pack up." "Oh, no, the night's young, let's go on somewhere else then." And we finally packed up. Got about 4 o'clock in the morning.
And these were the people from Piasecki that were?
These were Piasecki people. I think Michael Patterson was down there. He was our man in Washington at that time, the AE, but I can't really recall that. I think Mike was there, but I was so cross. Well, of course,
I knew that.
The meeting was set for 8:30 in the morning. I think I was the only one from the night before who was sitting at the table waiting for the meeting to go. That was my...
I knew the helicopter market at that time was competitive. I didn't realize it was that competitive.
Oh, yeah. It was quite remarkable. I was so taken aback by this. I was an innocent soul dealing with it. I dealt with it. And I can always remember that Piasecki meeting because, and I came back and wrote my report as a result of that.
Right.
When that report, I'd forgotten all about that report. And it was never bought until I left.
If I remember correctly, they had to re-engine those engines in order to make them come closer to meeting the staff requirement and to eliminate mechanical problems with the engine itself. I believe it was underpowered and suffered from vibration, which is one of the problems with that particular aircraft.
And what I said was quite true at that time. I recall, as you talk about it more and more, and I left before they finally agreed to purchase it, but the modifications, I think, were made.
Now this, if I remember correctly, this aircraft was going to be used primarily for the icebreaker.
That's right.
But the RCN at this stage had written into the staff requirement that not only did they want this aircraft for a utility role for the icebreaker, but they also wanted it for an ASW role, the dual capability, and that was written into the staff requirements, eventually to be eliminated.
Oh, okay. I can't recall that at all. You're pushing me a bit back. It's only when you mentioned the Piasecki meeting down there that I remembered.
All right. We'll just stop the tape here and turn it over.